Eric placed a hand on the counter to steady himself. Oh, yeah, just tired. When are they going to do it? Eric's mind was racing, trying to figure out a way to get Fred out in the shortened time frame. Tomorrow afternoon. Gonna be a firing squad, and I asked to be on it, Cortez said, as he tossed a freeze-dried pea in his mouth, smiling as he crunched it up. Eric wanted to beat the man to death where he stood. Not shoot him, but use his own hands to inflict pain. It took every bit of restraint he possessed to stand there and look at him. Well, I guess I'll see you then, Eric said. Cortez picked up the meals. Get there early so you can get a front row seat. Kay and Eric watched as Cortez walked out. As soon as the door shut, Eric looked at Kay. Tears were running down her face. Oh my God, what are we going to do? Kay asked as she fought back sobs. I'm going to kill that bastard, Eric said through gritted teeth. I can't believe they're going to do that. Kay shook her head. I just can't believe it. We'll have to get her out of here before tomorrow afternoon. Kay, please say you'll come. Kay nodded her head, wiping away tears. Yes, I'll come with you. If this is how they're going to act, I don't want to be here. Jess was raped. He deserved it. What those girls did was right. We are going to get them all, aren't we? Of course we are. I am not leaving any of them behind. Get ready. I'll let you know when I am. She gave him another quick hug. Eric left the kitchen and headed for his room. It was time for action. Chapter 16. We were running low on meat again. The fastest way to get some was to use the gill net in the creek to catch mullet. So we used the kayak to get the net across the river, just as we did last time. The difference now was that there just didn't seem to be any mullet in the river. We watched the creek for hours, even going up and down the river to look for them, but we came up empty. I guess we need to let the net sit for a while, Thad said. Yeah, let's leave it out for the rest of the day and see if it catches anything. No use waiting here, Danny said. Well, in that case, I'm going over to Chase's place. I want to see if he knows anyone around who might have taken the shots at us, I said. Danny adjusted his hat. You think he'll know? I shrugged. Can't hurt to ask. Plus, we can get out of here for a little. I'm going to stay here. I don't think I need a change of scenery, Thad said. Me too. I'll hang out with him, Jeff said. You want to see if Mel and Bobby want to go? Danny asked. Sure. We'll take the girls, too. Getting out of here would be nice for everyone. We'll take Sarge's big buggy so we can all fit. Danny gave me a look. You think he'll care? Hell no, he wouldn't care. Plus, he ain't here to say anything about it, I said with a grin. Cool. Let's get everyone rounded up and take a ride. Everyone was excited to leave the camp, even if it was just for a short trip up the road. After making sure we all had our weapons, Danny and I tossed our packs into the back. I got in behind the wheel with Mel beside me, and we headed out. This is fun, Little Bit said, holding her hand outside the buggy. It is nice to get out, Bobby agreed. Mel nodded her agreement. Taylor sat in the back with her face to the sky. The sun feels good. Even Leanne seemed to be enjoying the ride. She was at least looking around, not sitting with her face buried in her arms. The road was windswept, the only tracks on it from deer and other critters. We need to come hunt out here. The deer are obviously using the road a lot, Danny said. Can I go hunting with you? Taylor asked. We'll see, I replied. Come on, Dad, I want to go. You ever been hunting? Danny asked. She shook her head. No, but I want to try it. Danny looked at me. You never took her hunting? I laughed. She never wanted to get up early enough to go. Plus, she's been fishing with us before, and we know how that goes. Hey, what do you mean? Taylor shouted, half smiling. I did my best to mimic a teenage girl voice. I gotta pee. Can we go to the boat ramp? Danny started to laugh. Yeah, she never would use the can in the boat. But you're one to talk. You can't piss out of the boat either. Hey, that's not from lack of effort. It's the whole bobbing up and down thing, I said. Taylor rolled her eyes, and Mel hit me in the arm playfully. Ew, Dad. But yeah, I still want to go hunting, though, Taylor said. You're quick to volunteer for things that involve guns, Danny said. She does like her some shooting irons, I said. Taylor smiled. You know you can't use that machine gun to deer hunt. I know, I know. I just want to go. I think we can work it out, Danny said. We drove on, chatting. About half a mile down the road, I pointed out a large patch of leafy greens. Ooh, we gotta stop here on the way back and pick that, I said, pointing to it. What is it? Danny asked. Mustard? It's in the same family and tastes a lot like it. It's called wintercress. Yuck. Mustard greens are gross, Taylor said. I looked back at her. Shoot. When you were a baby, you would sit in my lap and eat them as long as I would feed them to you. I knocked on the window, gesturing toward the greens. You ate that very type all the time. I remember that. You're so cute, Tay, Mel said. Well, I ain't a baby anymore, Taylor replied. Chase's place wasn't that far from our camp, so it didn't take long to get there. As we got closer, Danny told me to slow down. Let's see if anyone is around before we go running up in there. I stopped and we watched the place, looking for any sign of life. After a few minutes, I honked the horn. The front door opened slowly, and Chase stepped out, holding his turkey gun. Hey, Chase! It's me, Morgan! I called out. Can we come up? Chase looked around, then waved us up. Hey, Chase, how you been? I asked as I got out. We're doing, he replied. Seeing it was safe, his wife and daughter came outside as well. The ladies started to chat, while Danny and me talked to Chase. Looking around, I asked, Where are the boys? They set out on their own. Really? Just left? Danny asked. Yeah, about a week ago. Said it was boring around here. Where'd they go? I asked. Chase shrugged. Got no idea. Haven't seen hide nor hair since they left. Andy's mama's a little worried about him. Told him it was a bad idea. But he's pert near growed, and left anyway. How have you guys been here? Danny asked. Chase scratched at what now was a very full beard. We're all right. I managed to get enough out of the woods to feed us. Sure could use some vegetables, though. You see them patches of wintercress down the road? I asked, pointing back the way we came. What? The green stuff on the west side? Yeah. They're kind of like mustard greens. Good to know. I thought it looked like mustard greens, but wasn't sure and didn't want to get anyone sick, he said. It's good to eat. We're going to pick some on the way back, I said. Some fresh greens would be good. I found a lemon tree, and we've been eating them. Sour is all get out, but we need it. Wow, a lemon tree, that'd be nice, Danny said. It has been. I'd trade you some, but we've about cleaned it out now. Thanks anyway, Danny said with a smile. How's your daughter been feeling? I asked. Chase looked over at her. He wasn't the type of man to show emotion, from what I gathered, but I'm sure he was smiling on the inside. She's been real good. Boiling the water really helps, and that bleach idea y'all had really helped out too. Good. Glad to hear it, I said. Hey, Chase, you seen anyone around lately? Danny asked. About a week ago, a couple of fellers came through here. Said they was from Orlando. Had to get out 'cause it got so bad there. Did they say where they were heading? I asked. Nah, just said they was passing through. Did they have any guns? Danny asked. One of them had an old H&R, single shotgun. Why? They give y'all some trouble? Someone was sneaking around our place at night. Then the next day, they took a shot at Danny with some sort of shotgun. I left out the part about Danny shooting up the creek.
I think I heard that. Heard a whole bunch of shooting one night not long ago.
Yeah, that was probably it. I was just curious if you'd seen anyone around, Danny replied.
Not since them two fellers, but they came through about a week before I heard the shooting, so I don't think they're your guys, Chase said.
We talked a little more about what each of us was doing to get by. I told Chase about the squirrel snares and explained the concept to him. He said he'd give it a try. He'd been concentrating on hunting, shooting deer, and even a turkey. Bet that was nice, Danny said.
Yeah, it was. I cooked it on the grill. Best meal we've had in a while.
We haven't seen any turkeys yet. I'd like to, though, I said.
I'd like to see more of them myself. I'll fight you for it, he said with a chuckle.
How are you fixed for ammo? Danny asked.
Been doing most of my hunting with my .22, trying to save the shotgun and rifle ammo. I still got a couple of 122s, a couple boxes of birdshot, some turkey loads, and slugs, and buck.
If you get to where you need some, come by. Ammo is something we've got, I said. Chase smiled.
I figured you for the type to hoard ammo.
He nodded at the carbine slung across my chest. After talking a little longer, we said our goodbyes and got back in the buggy. Everyone wanted to ride a bit longer. They weren't ready to go home yet. I told them we could for a little while, and we continued on the road, away from the camp. There were several houses in the area, though none of them seemed occupied. All the homes showed the lack of human attention, leaves piled up all over the yards and roofs, lawns composed almost solely of weeds. The dirt road met a paved road at the transfer station in Paisley. As we passed the site, Danny suggested we ride over to Clear Lake Campground. As soon as he suggested it, there was no getting out of it, as it was met by cheers from all the girls. We rolled down Highway 42 at a good clip. The ride was so smooth that I was soon going 70 without realizing it. Just as I started to slow down, the sign for the campground came into view. The campground was much like I remembered it, just with an air of neglect about it. The small shack at the entry was actually lying on its side. All the windows had been knocked out, and shards of glass littered the ground. I stopped beside it.
"You think it's a good idea to be here?" I asked, as I looked at the broken glass.
"Yeah, it doesn't look like there has been anyone through here in a long time," Danny said.
"Let's ride through, just check it out," Bobby said.
We drove past the gate and down the narrow paved track that was now covered in leaves and other natural debris. The namesake for the park, Clear Lake, sat on the west side of the campground. On our way there, Bobby suddenly shouted, "Stop!" I slammed on the brakes, looking for whatever she saw. Bobby was pointing to a small building.
A bathroom!
Bobby's idea was immediately seized on by the rest of the girls, so I pulled up to it and everyone got out. Danny and I cleared it, then waited by the buggy.
Wonder how the fishing is in the lake now? Danny asked, as he leaned over the front end of the buggy.
You think it'd be better with fewer people around now? I replied. A breeze picked up, blowing through the trees and dropping even more leaves down on us. It carried with it the very familiar smell of wood smoke.
You smell that? I asked.
Danny stood up and looked around.
Yeah, I do. Wonder where it's coming from.
We looked around for the source, but couldn't get a visual on anything or anyone.
Someone's out here, I said.
Yeah,
Let's keep our eyes open. You still want to go through, or do you want to leave? I asked. Nah, I don't want to leave yet. Let's just see who's here. When all the girls finished using the facilities, we loaded up. I told them about the smoke and asked them to keep their eyes peeled. I can smell it too, Taylor said, as she adjusted the sling in her H&K. She had the slightest bit of worry on her face. I'd pulled back out onto the road and continued to follow the loop around toward the lake. I was driving slowly, not wanting to run into an ambush, which was a strange thought in itself. A few months ago, I would never consider an ambush a potential road hazard, but that was the reality in this new life. There, there, Mel said, pointing to a campsite just beyond the woods. I stopped the buggy, and Danny and I got out to look the camp over. There were two tents, as well as a lean-to-style structure that appeared to be used for cooking. It was then that Danny noticed four people down at the lake, a man, a woman, and two children, from the looks of it. Let's go say hi, Danny said. I don't want to get shot. You and me coming up to them like this through the woods isn't going to look very friendly. Why don't you get Bobby and you two walk out and call to them? I'll cover you from over here, I replied. They've got kids. I don't think they're a threat. Yeah, well, better safe than sorry. All right, let me get her, Danny said. Danny and Bobby walked out through the campsite while I took up a position where I could cover them, but hopefully not be seen. They held hands as they walked. Danny had his carbine slung behind his back to look less threatening. When they got to the edge of the campsite, Danny called out, "Hello!" and waved. The people at the water's edge immediately looked up. The woman grabbed the two kids and pulled them behind her, while the man moved to pick up a rifle leaning against a chair. I raised my carbine and drew a bead on him. If he shouldered it, I would have to shoot him, not something I wanted to do in front of his kids. "Can we come down?" Bobby called out. The two exchanged words for a moment. Then the man said something I couldn't hear. Danny and Bobby started walking toward them as the man walked to meet them, still clutching his rifle. They stopped a short distance from each other and talked, Danny gesturing toward the campsite. After another minute of talking, the man called to the woman and motioned for her to meet them. Holding the kids' hands, she cautiously made her way toward Danny and Bobby. When I saw Danny and Bobby start back up toward the camp, I headed over toward the buggy. "What's going on?" Mel asked. "I think they're coming up here." "Is everything going to be all right?" Little Bit asked. "I think so, don't worry," I said to her as I rubbed her head. She smiled, but didn't really look like she believed it. Danny and Bobby came up. "Are they friendly? What are they doing?" I asked. "They're coming up to meet everyone." "What do you say?" I asked. "Not much, just that we scared the hell out of him." "Good thing he didn't know I was watching, or he would have really been scared." The couple came to the edge of their campsite and stopped. They were looking us over when a little girl about Ashley's age grabbed her mother's hand. "Mommy, can I play with her?" she asked, pointing at Little Bit. Her mother looked at Ash, then at us. I don't know. Mel looked up. "Oh, they can play. They both could probably use some time around other kids." The woman smiled. "Okay." She looked down at her daughter. "Go ahead." The little girl ran up to the buggy. "You want to play with me?" Little Bit looked up at Mel, who nodded at her. She smiled and jumped out of the buggy, and they ran back toward the tents. I smiled at them. "We should all be more like kids. Kids are lucky. They still retain a little of their innocence," the man said, sticking out his hand. "I'm Tyler, and this is my wife, Brandy."
We did a quick round of introductions, and they invited us into their camp. We took seats in a couple of logs they'd dragged around the pit. Brandy was very obviously uncomfortable with the amount of weaponry sitting across the fire from her. Everyone except Leanne and Little Bit had at least one firearm, and Danny and I each had two. I couldn't blame her. I'd be nervous too. "Where are you guys from?" Mel asked Brandy.
"Daytona, not too far from the beach."
"Did it get bad there?" Danny asked.
"Yes and no. It was weird. The beach always draws a lot of transient types, so that became an even more serious problem. But the biggest issue was resources. There were so many people there, and not enough to go around," Tyler said.
"What about you guys? Where are you from?" Brandy asked.
"We live nearby," Mel said.
"Must be nice not to have to leave home," Brandy said.
"It hasn't been easy. We've had our share of problems, too," Danny said.
"It's a nice Ruger, Tyler," I said, pointing to the rifle in his lap.
"Yeah, she wasn't real happy when I bought it," he smiled at her, "but it was worth it in the end."
"Yeah, sadly, guns are necessary tools these days."
"Mom, sorry to interrupt, but I have to use the bathroom," Taylor said.
"Oh, use the one right over there," Brandy said, pointing to a nearby restroom. "It's the one we use. It's pretty clean."
"Leanne, go with her," Mel said. Leanne didn't reply, but did get up and walk away with her sister. As they walked, they came across the two younger girls, squealing and running. Ashley and Tyler's daughter came running through the center of the camp, being chased by a little boy.
"What's your daughter's name?" Mel asked.
"Her name's Edie, and her brother, the monster over there, is Jace," Brandy answered.
"They look like a handful. How old are they?"
"Edie is 7, and Jace is 6.
This got raised eyebrows from Mel and Bobby.
"Wow, you're brave," Mel said with a laugh.
"Yeah, well," Brandy looked at Tyler.
"It wasn't supposed to be like that, but it happened."
Tyler laughed.
"It's always my fault. If I remember right, you were there too."
Now I laughed. "Amen, brother, amen." We talked for some time about what's happened since that fateful day. They told us about their time in Daytona, of people taking over resources that should have been available to all, and demanding payment in exchange for drawing water from a lake. There were also gang fights, wars as they called them, to control such resources. I asked about the beach, if they ever tried to get out there to fish, but Tyler said it was impossible to get on the beach, even as a local. As we grew more comfortable, I told them of my trip home and about the raiders.
"I've heard of the camp. We traveled with some people who were trying to get there. They said it was the answer to all of the problems they were dealing with," Tyler said.
"Yeah, I don't think it lives up to the advertising," Danny said.
"Well, that's why we're here and not there. I'd rather take care of my family myself."
"What'd you guys do for work before all this went down?" I asked.
"I worked for the county in maintenance, and Brandy was an elementary school teacher."
Bobby looked at Brandy.
"Oh my. What was it like in the school?"
"Horrible. Despite all the preparedness crap they talked about, all the drills they did, they were totally unprepared. Even if it had only been a couple of days, they weren't prepared."
"What'd they do with all the kids?" Mel asked.
"That whole shelter-in-place thing is such a joke. The first day, there was nearly a riot because the administration wouldn't release kids to their parents. We had used an electronic system for ID verification, and since it didn't work, they didn't know what to do, and of course, there was no backup. The water went out way faster than I would have thought, and things just got worse from there."
"Where were your kids?"
"They were in daycare. I managed to get home, and then went to pick them up on an old 2-stroke motorcycle I had.
It wasn't an easy trip, but we did it, Tyler said.
What happened to all of your students? Bobby asked.
But Tyler came to the school to let me know he had the kids. Once I knew they were all right, I stayed to try and help in the classrooms. They finally started letting kids go when their parents showed up with guns. I mean, I can't blame them. I would have too. But when I left, there were still six of my students there. Her voice grew softer. I don't know where their parents were. It was really sad. I hated to leave them.
Wow. I can't imagine how horrible it must have been to leave those kids behind, Mel said.
It was awful. But I had my own kids to think of. It became clear the situation was only going to get worse. I went there every day to bring stuff to Brandy. After a few weeks, I knew we had to go. It just wasn't safe, Tyler said.
How'd you guys get out of Daytona? I mean, you couldn't all ride on that motorcycle, Bobby said.
I traded the Suzuki for that cart and some other stuff, Tyler said, pointing to a two-wheeled cart attached to a mountain bike. Between that one and the kid's cart, we were able to get out of town pretty quickly.
If it wasn't for that cart, I don't know how we would have hauled everything.
We already had the kid's trailer, which made life easier, Brandy said.
So you guys ride from place to place on those? Danny asked.
Yeah, we're looking for a place to call home, so to speak. But it's hard, because every time we find a nice place, there's either someone already there, or people show up, and we leave because they put off a bad vibe, Tyler said, then jutted a thumb over his shoulder.
Where'd you guys get that rig out there? Looks pretty sweet.
It's not ours. Belongs to a friend, I said.
Looks military.
It is.
Man, that'd be nice. But I guess gas would be an issue.
Tyler stared thoughtfully into the coals of the fire, then looked up.
You guys remember that show Doomsday Preppers?
I used to watch that and laugh at those people. I thought they were all so crazy.
But they were right. Everyone called them crazy. But they're probably the best off out of any of us.
A lot of them were nuts, Danny said.
Not just them, but all those people. They called them preppers, survivalists, or nutcases. But they were onto something. I wish I'd been one of them.
Hey, man, you've done a pretty damn good job so far from the looks of it. You're here, your family's healthy. It isn't about what you've got, but what you're capable of, I said.
I'd be capable of a lot more if I had more, though, Tyler said with a laugh.
Wouldn't we all? I chuckled.
How long have you guys been here?
4 days so far.
You plan on staying put?
As long as we can. There's water, fish in the lake, and plenty of firewood, Tyler said, waving toward the tree line.
How's the fishing in the lake? We were talking about that when we were driving in, Danny remarked.
Great so far.
Are you guys hunting at all? I asked.
A little, but I don't have much ammo left. I'm down to 10 rounds for the Mini 14. I have a little 22 too, but only a few rounds left for it.
I looked at Danny, who gave a knowing nod. I pulled a mag from my vest and started to strip rounds from it. Tyler looked on, unsure of what I was doing at first.
Here, Tyler, take these for now, I said, holding the rounds out.
Tyler looked at Brandy, then back at me.
I can't take these. I have nothing to offer in exchange.
This isn't a trade, man. You've got a family to protect. I gestured toward my family. I can relate.
Tyler stuck out his hand.
Thanks, Morgan. I really appreciate it.
We'll be by in the next day or so with some 22 ammo, too, Danny said.
Wow, I don't know what to say.
It's uncommon today to see someone willing to do anything for someone else, Brandy said.
We don't have much ourselves, but we can spare a little ammo. Nowadays, you need it to feed and defend yourself.
It's a modern necessity, Danny said.
Tyler nodded. Sad, but true.
It's starting to get late. We're going to head home, I said, as I stood up.
It was nice to meet y'all, Mel said with a smile.
Danny and Bobby said the same, and Brandy shared her sentiments as well.
Come on, Ashley. We have to go now, Mel called out.
The kids were sitting together, stacking sticks like a log cabin.
Aw, come on, Mom, can't we stay a little longer?
No, it's time to go. She pouted and stomped her way over, then ran back and hugged her new friend. After rounding her up, we headed back to the buggy, where the older girls were hanging out. Tyler and Brandy came over to say goodbye.
Thanks again for the ammo. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, Brandy added.
No problem. You guys be safe, Danny said.
They waved as we pulled out. Mel leaned forward and commented.
They seem pretty nice.
Bobby agreed with her.
I hope they're going to be all right.
That's why I gave them the ammo. I hope it wasn't a mistake, I said.
What do you mean? Mel asked.
You know, people aren't always what they appear. But since they don't know where we live, I'm not worried about them. She looked at me like I was nuts.
They're just a couple with two kids. They aren't going to hurt you.
I guess you forgot the story I told you about my trip home, when that couple with kids nearly killed me.
She didn't say anything, turning instead to look out the side of the buggy.
I stopped on the way back to pick up the greens I pointed out to Chase. They'd make a nice addition to dinner. We made it back to the camp without seeing anyone on the road. Pulling up to the camp, I saw Jeff sitting by the fire, poking at something inside of a pot.
What's in the pot? I asked Jeff as we all sat down.
Some more limb rats. Thad and I went out to check the snares. We took 22s with us and managed to shoot a bunch, so we got a good dinner going for tonight.
Cool, I said, then looked around.
Where's Thad?
Jeff jerked his head toward the pig pen.
He's back there. We cut up a cabbage palm, and he's throwing it to the hogs. He brought in the net earlier. There weren't many fish.
A few minutes later, Thad walked up, carrying something.
Hey, little bit. Come see what I got, he said.
As he got closer, I could see what it was. A tiny piglet.
It's a baby piggy, she shouted when he knelt down. It's so cute. Are there more?
Thad was smiling.
There's six more with the mama. You want to come see them? We need to get him back so we can eat.
Little Bit started hopping up and down.
Yes, yes, yes. I want to go see them.
We all walked over to the pen to find the mama pig lying under a small tree nursing her brood. The piglets were a mass of tiny bodies all trying to get a teat. The girls were gushing over them. Little Bit wanted to get in the pen. As Thad leaned over and gently laid the piglet on its mama's side, he said she needed to wait a few more days. She frowned, but was quickly transfixed.
I didn't even know she was pregnant, Danny said.
Me neither, Thad said with a smile. But I'm glad she was. In a couple of months, we'll have a bunch of pork.
Yeah.
We could butcher one of the others now that we have more, I said.
Yeah. It'll be nice when they get a little bigger. Maybe barter with someone, Danny said.
I laughed. Barter for what?
He shrugged.
Dunno. Guess we'd have to find someone to barter with first.
How was the drive? Thad asked.
Good. Chase is still hanging in there. Those boys all left, though, I said.
Thad raised his eyebrows.
Really? Wonder where they went.
No idea. He doesn't have any idea either, I said.
We went over to Clear Lake and met a couple over there with two little kids, Danny said.
Thad nodded.
Where'd they come from?
Daytona. They rode bikes all the way here, I said.
Pretty long ride,
especially with two kids. They had a couple of cool little trailers, one for the kids and one for all their gear.
That's a good idea. Thad nudged me and smiled. Bikes would have been nice on our trip home, wouldn't they?
I laughed.
You ain't lying, brother. I would have given almost anything for a bike back then.
What's in the pot on the fire, Thad? Mel asked, as she walked over.
Just boil in some squirrels.
Tonight we'll have squirrel and grits, Thad said with a smile.
That should be interesting, but I'll trust your instincts, Chef, Mel said with a wink.
We went back over to the fire over Little Bit's protests. Soon, everyone gathered around the tables for dinner, the light of the oil lamps illuminating our surprisingly delicious meal. This was a nice habit we'd gotten into, everyone coming together to eat and talk. The real reason for it was that we had to prepare communal meals, and that forced everyone to eat at the same time. But it developed into something we all looked forward to. It was a very happy circumstance, something that was needed in these unsure times.
Chapter 17. Sarge stood before the assembled non-commissioned officers.
Everyone clear in their assignments?
He was answered by a row of a half dozen nodding heads.
Remember, we want to do this without firing a shot. Shooting is the last thing we want to do, but if it comes to it, pour it to them and attain fire superiority quickly. We want to avoid civilian casualties. That's a priority. It won't do us any good to free the camp if we're killing the very people we're there to help. We roll out at 0600 tomorrow morning. Any questions?
He was met with silence.
All right, then get your trucks in order. Make sure your squads are squared away and be ready in the morning.
As the crowd broke up, Sarge joined Sheffield and Livingston.
I hope this works, Sheffield said.
It will if everyone does their jobs right, especially you. They've got to buy into the fact that you're an army officer sent to assist them.
As Sheffield was thinking that over, Vance walked up.
Captain, what do you want me to do tomorrow?
You stay here and keep an eye on the folks we're leaving behind. Once we take the camp down, we'll send someone back. We'll move everyone over there, where we can have shelter and access to supplies.
Vance looked unhappy.
What? Just because I don't have a black rifle, I can't go?
The army hasn't carried lever actions for some time now, Sarge said with a grin, looking at Vance's .357 lever gun.
Vance laughed.
I guess not. Fine. I don't mind sticking around here.
Besides, you gotta keep an eye on them three. We got trussed up over there, Sarge said.
Vance looked in the direction where the prisoners were being kept.
No problem. Me and a couple of the guys will keep watch. I've already talked with them, and we'll split it up into shifts.
Good. Be careful with them. Don't take any guff from them.
Vance smiled.
Oh, we won't, he said, as he headed off toward the camp.
All right, let's make sure everyone has their shit together, Sarge said, then looked at Ted and Mike. You two make sure all the trucks are ready to go in the morning.
The guys nodded and headed off to where the trucks were being staged. Sarge went off to get his own gear ready. He would be riding in one of the lead Hummers with the officers. The rest of the day was a flurry of activity, with everyone getting ready to move. It wasn't until late in the evening when things finally started to wind down, and the camp got quiet. The NCOs broke up with their respective squads to go over the plan again. Sarge stood in front of the CP tent, looking out over the numerous small fires that were burning, each one representing a squad. The guard unit was made up of engineers. While they were trained for combat, it was never their primary mission, though the combat requirements of the various Gulf Wars and Afghanistan meant that nearly all of them had seen combat. For many of them, their orders were to act as if they belonged there, which wasn't hard in theory.
But the idea of rolling into a FEMA facility and facing the unknown kept many of them awake that night. Sarge was up at 0400. After dressing and putting his gear on, he headed out to look over the convoy. For the most part, the camp was still asleep. Only the sentries were up and moving. Sarge nodded as he passed them. Each of them had a hard look about them, trying to steel their nerves for what lay ahead. A little after 0500, Ted and Mike found Sarge leaning on the hood of the Hummer he would be riding in. They joined him and stood together as the camp began to come alive, silently observing the activity in front of them. The air was heavy with morning dew, giving everything a clammy feel. By 0530, the camp was fully awake, with people moving all over. Wives were hugging their husbands, who were about to leave on the mission, and in a few cases, those roles were reversed. At 0600, Sarge stood at the door of his Hummer, looking back along the column. It wasn't very long, 8 large trucks and 5 Hummers, but it looked impressive enough. Diesel exhaust hung low around the line of vehicles. With everyone loaded, it was time to move out. Mike, Ian, Jamie, and Perez were in the lead Hummer, while Sarge, Sheffield, and Ted were in the number 2 truck. After performing a quick radio check with each truck, they started to move out. 5 miles of dirt roads took them from the Highland Pines down into low oak hammocks and swamplands before reaching the paved road. The route had been memorized by every member of the unit. 1 left turn and 1 right turn, then the camp would be on the left, several miles down the road. Sarge watched the scenery as it passed by, smiling to himself. Unlike many of the others, he was at ease and not even thinking of what lay ahead. At Highway 19, they turned right for the last leg of the ride.
"You ready, Captain?" Sarge asked Sheffield.
"Ready as I'll ever be. Just remember, for the purposes of this mission, we're on the same side as they are. Don't look at them as the opposition, at least not yet."
Sheffield nodded and pulled out the drawing the guys had made of the camp. It was going to be one of the best pieces of evidence they'd offer to Mr. Tabor to prove their allegiance. Despite his efforts to remain calm, Sheffield's stomach was in knots. He wasn't certain this was going to work, and they'd be inside the perimeter of the camp, with nowhere to maneuver if it didn't. As they approached the sign that read, "Naval Bombing Range Ocala," Sarge slipped his Kevlar helmet on. This, too, was part of the ruse. They had to look the part of an army unit. And his old ratty, a 101st Airborne hat, wasn't exactly regulation.
"All right, Ian, nice and slow, till you see their gate," Sarge said into his mic.
Ian turned onto the access road to the range, slowing down so those behind him could catch up. As they eased down the road, the burned-out bus came into view.
"That's your doing?" Sarge shouted up to Ted, who was manning the saw in the turret.
Ted smiled and nodded back. Sarge shook his head, but couldn't help but smile. Shortly after the gate came into view, 3 men in front of the bunker became visible. Sarge looked at Sheffield and clapped his hands.
"It's game time! You ready?"
Looking quite the opposite, he nodded. They halted the trucks, and Sheffield, Livingston, Sarge, and Ted all got out and approached the now 6 men gathered at the bunker. They were carrying on a lively conversation amongst themselves. Ted kept a close eye on them as they were all armed, although none of them attempted to raise a weapon. In the lead Hummer, Mike kept the saw pointed in their general direction, though not directly at them, as he didn't want to instill fear. Upon reaching the men, Sarge waited for Sheffield to speak first. It was important that the ranking officer be the first to say anything. Sheffield nodded at the men, who simply stared back.
"Gentlemen, I'm Captain Sheffield. I need to talk to your CO, Tabor.
The six men looked at one another, unsure of how to respond. They had clearly never been told what to do if the military rolled up and started talking. In fact, the only thing they'd been told of the army was that they would attack. This soft approach completely threw them. Sarge, being the diplomat he was growing impatient with their bewildered silence.
Get on the horn to your CO now, damn it! It wasn't a fucking request, Sarge shouted.
The sudden outburst startled the men, causing some of them to visibly jump. Two of them quickly disappeared into the bunker. Tabor was at his desk, going through the reams of paperwork piled on it. Even after the world ended, paperwork continued.
Main gate to Alpha One.
Tabor looked at the radio.
Why in the hell are they calling me?
He picked up the handset on his desk and punched a couple of buttons.
Ed, see what those idiots at the gate want, would you?
Then he picked up the mic to his radio.
Stand by.
Sure thing, Ed said.
He left his office and climbed on an ATV and headed for the gate. As the gate came into view, he was shocked at what he saw. A line of Hummers and trucks and several men standing at the gate in army uniforms. He quickly dismounted and stepped up to the group.
What's going on? He asked.
You Tabor? Sheffield asked.
No, I'm his deputy commander, Ed Moreland.
Sheffield took a step forward.
I'm Captain Sheffield. I need to speak with Tabor immediately.
Ed, just like the men at the gate, was unsure of how to respond.
What's this in reference to?
Sheffield looked at the black-clad men beside Ed.
It's a private security matter of utmost urgency.
Ed looked around nervously.
All right, you guys follow me in. Just leave the rest of your people here.
Sheffield nodded, and they got back in the Hummer. Ted was up in the turret and got a bird's-eye view of the camp as they drove through. They drew a number of looks from the surprised camp staff, who stopped and gawked at the passing truck. Ted surveyed the camp as they passed through it, paying particular attention to the detainees. Groups of detainees were doing physical labor, everything from filling sandbags to erecting additional tents. The scene was always the same, black-clad men watching over them with guns at their side.
Hugh, field boss, Ted thought.
As they passed through, the detainees glanced at the vehicle sideways, not rising from their toil. The DHS troopers, on the other hand, gawked, pointing and gesturing amongst themselves.
Well, we're in, Livingston muttered.
Yeah, went better than I thought, Sheffield said.
Remember, Captain, just like we discussed, these guys are clueless for the most part. If we convince Tabor, the rest will fall in line, Sarge said.
Right. Have you noticed all the people working? Sheffield asked.
Yeah, seems like everyone's busy, Livingston replied.
Yeah, they're busy all right. Hard not to be when there's a man with a gun standing over you, Sarge remarked.
Sheffield looked out the window.
I noticed that every group has more than one guard standing over them.
You think those folks are out there working like that by choice? Did you see the water jugs? Sarge asked.
And a cup tied to it. I'm sure they're having to ask for a drink of water. Probably gotta ask permission to piss, too, Sarge said.
That just ain't right.
Grown men having to ask for permission to take a piss, Livingston said.
Or women.
Sarge waved a hand at the window.
I've seen plenty of women out there working as well.
I understand now why this needs to be done. There's no liberty. What they are doing here is obviously a forced labor situation. I can't even imagine what the rest of their day-to-day is like, Sheffield said.
Well, if all goes well, soon we'll find out, Sarge said.
The ATV stopped in front of a line of shipping containers converted into offices. Ed climbed off and waited
as Sarge and his crew exited the Hummer. He looked at them, wanting to tell them to leave their weapons in the truck, but glanced up at Ted on the saw and changed his mind. Ed stepped up to an office and rapped on the doorframe.
"Hey, Chuck, you need to come out here."
Tabor looked up from the reports he was reading on his desk.
"What is it, Ed? I'm busy."
"No, you really need to come to the conference room," Ed said, stepping aside so Tabor could see the men in ACU uniforms. Tabor practically leapt from his chair and came around his desk.
"Captain Sheffield, this is Charles Tabor, our camp commander," Ed said.
"Mr. Tabor, good to meet you. You got somewhere we can talk in private?" Sheffield said, as he offered his hand. Tabor shook his hand, uncertain of what was going on.
Sure, over here," he said, gesturing to the conference room, then looked at Ed with a WTF look.
Ed shrugged, as he was just as confused by the appearance of the United States Army as Tabor was. Sheffield glanced at Sarge, who nodded. They filed in and sat down.
"What can we do for you, Captain?" Tabor asked.
"We've got intel that indicates there are elements of your security force plotting to overthrow the camp. These elements may be aligned with guerrilla forces outside the camp." Sheffield delivered the comment exactly as they'd rehearsed. Tabor and Ed were clearly shocked by the information and sat in silence.
"My security force, Captain?" Tabor finally said.
"Yes, sir," Sarge said, as he unfolded the drawing of the camp. "We captured some individuals and found this on them. Through interrogations, we learned of the plot, but we don't know how many of your people are involved in the plan."
He slid the drawing across the table to Tabor. Tabor picked it up, and he and Ed examined it, as Sarge continued.
"As you can see, there are facilities noted there that could only come from someone with inside information."
Tabor looked at Ed, and then laid the drawing on the table.
"Captain, you will forgive me for being skeptical, but as you know, there are some, how should I put it, issues between the armed forces and the DHS.
I understand that, and I assure you this is real. Some of us are still patriots. We're here to help you put this down before it gets out of hand. We're not sure if this is an attempt on just your camp, or if it's part of a larger plan to take down other camps as well. That's why we need to identify the actors and interrogate them for additional information," Sheffield said.
Inwardly, Sarge smiled.
"Damn fine acting, Captain. Damn fine."
"Have you had any issues with any of your people lately?" Sarge asked, baiting them into bringing up the three missing people currently being held back at the guard camp.
Ed looked over at Tabor.
"Might explain those missing personnel."
Sarge seized the moment.
"You got missing people?"
"Yeah, we had three go missing recently. They were on the rear gate and just disappeared," Tabor said.
"Well, that's not good.
Were there any known issues with them?" Livingston asked.
"For the most part, no. Though we had some behavioral issues with one of them, a woman," Ed said.
Sarge fought back a smile again.
"I knew that bitch was trouble."
"Then as you can see, we're not here by accident," Sarge said.
"How big of a threat do you think this is?" Tabor asked.
"You've got several hundred civilians in here, and you've also got an armory full of weapons. We do not want those two things to mix. Let's just say that," Sheffield said.
Tabor let out a long breath.
"All right. What do you propose we do?"
"I seriously doubt that there are too many of your people involved in this plot, as it would be hard to keep something like this a secret for long. But we can't take any chances until we sort out who is and who isn't a threat. I would suggest that you assemble your security people and have them turn in their weapons. Then we, you and my intel team, will interview them. As they are either cleared or identified as conspirators, they will be either detained or released to return to their duties," Sheffield said.
This was the moment that would determine if the plan would succeed or not, and he could hardly keep from tapping his foot nervously. Tabor sat back in his chair.
Who were these people you captured? Where were they caught?
As far as we know, they are civilians. One claimed to have escaped from here. He's the one that had the map. They thought we would assist in their plan and gave the info up freely at first, Sarge said.
Tabor looked at Ed.
How many people have gotten out?
Ed thought for a minute.
Six, not including the guards.
How'd you bag these folks? Tabor asked.
Like I said, at first they approached us. Once they figured out we weren't who they thought we were, they clammed up. But the cat was out of the bag by then.
And with a little encouragement, we were able to get more info out of them, Sarge said.
Ed smiled.
What sort of encouragement?
I believe the proper term is enhanced interrogation techniques, Livingston said.
Ed smiled and looked at Tabor.
They should meet Niigata.
Tabor rolled his eyes.
What's that now? Sarge asked.
Tabor waved his hand dismissively.
Back to your prisoners. Where are they now?
In a secure location for the moment, Sheffield said.
Why didn't you bring them here?
They could help point out who's involved.
We thought about that, and we'll bring them in later. But if we paraded them through here now and the people involved saw them with us, we'd lose the element of surprise, making this a hell of a lot harder, Sarge said.
Did they have any ID on them? Tabor asked.
Sarge laughed. No, not like anyone carries a wallet these days.
I'd like to ID the one who said he escaped from here.
If you issue photo IDs to your detainees, when we bring him in, you can go through your files and find out who he is.
We might be able to connect him to some of the other conspirators that way, Sarge said.
Ed looked at Tabor. We do issue photo IDs. That'd be easy enough to do. We'll know where he was housed and what details he was on. It might shed some light on the people in here who are in on it.
Tabor sat staring at the map.
It was obvious he was conflicted.
To help make his decision easier, Sarge decided to make another play.
Mr. Tabor, part of the plot called for the torture and execution of the camp administration. Now I don't know how many people that is here. Maybe it's just you and Ed, maybe more. But we take this kind of thing seriously in the armed forces, and I suggest you do the same.
Who's going to take care of security when we call everyone in? These people will take advantage of the situation if given half a chance, Ed said.
We'll handle that. Our people will take over their positions and run your camp during the vetting process. As your people are cleared, they can return to their posts, and our people will pull out.
I don't think it will even be noticed by the majority of your detainees, Livingston said.
Ed looked at Tabor.
What are we going to tell them we're bringing them in for?
Tabor was overwhelmed and shook his head.
I don't know.
Why don't you tell them we're here to inventory weapons? Say we've got armorers with us, and they will go through them and make sure they're all up to speed, Sarge said.
That could work.
That'd explain why they're turning in their weapons, Ed said.
We really do have armorers, and they'll check out the weapons. We can also do an inventory for you to make sure everyone has the correct weapon, too.
It's a good idea. We've been meaning to do that, but it's been quite a trial to figure out how to do that without compromising the safety of the camp, Tabor said.
Sounds like we're in agreement, then. Can my people come on up? Sarge asked.
Sure, Tabor said, then looked at Ed.
Go ahead and call the gate. Tell them to let them through.
I'll go call my folks, Sarge said as he stood up.
As Sarge headed for the door, he was stopped by Ed.
Hey, First Sergeant, want some coffee?
Sarge smiled.
Damn right I do. Let me make this call, and I'll be right back. Ed started to pour him a cup as Sarge stepped out. Ted looked over as Sarge came out.
What's the word?
It's showtime, Sarge said. Call him in, Teddy.
Roger that,
Ted said as he climbed into the turret.
I want that last Hummer to stay at the gate. Let me know when they get here. Soon as that's done, you and Mikey get over to their comm shack and shut it down,
Sarge said quietly as he spun around and headed back inside. Ted gave him a thumbs up and Sarge headed back in, eager for that cup of coffee. It was still dark when Eric snuck out to the fence behind the detention facility. He looked around to make sure no one saw him and pulled the small bolt cutters out of his pocket. His plan was to cut the fence at one of the poles, then cut the ties holding the top to the crossbar all the way across to the next pole. He hoped that by loosening the foundations, the Hummer could break through the fence. He snipped the first wire, and it gave with a snap loud enough to wake the dead. He froze where he was and checked around again. At this rate, it was going to take forever. The sun was already above the horizon as he finished the second fence. He'd worked up quite a sweat, and as he walked back toward the motor pool, a chill crept into him. He quickly put the bolt cutters back and was on his way to his room